Soon afterwards, he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large crowd. Now, as he approached the gate of the city, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a sizable crowd from the city was with her. And so it would turn out on this fateful day that these two crowds would meet up at the gate of the village of Nain. Two very different crowds, one coming into the city, the other leaving the city. One had made a great discovery. The other was grieving a terrible loss. One had discovered the source of true life, and the other confronted with the tragedy of death. Both crowds would witness an amazing turn of events. Going back to verse number 12, the text says, "Now as he approached the gate of the city, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a sizable crowd from the city was with her." The story continues. "When Jesus saw her, he felt compassion for her and said to her, 'Do not weep.' And he came up and touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. And he said, 'Young man, I say to you, arise.' The dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. Fear gripped them all, and they began glorifying God, saying, 'A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people.' This report concerning him went out all over Judea and in all the surrounding districts." I love this story. If we're allowed to have favorites, it is without doubt one of my favorite Bible stories. And I tell you why. I try to imagine what it would be like if that happened today. Can you imagine that? Just about the time Klein High School is letting out. I know I haven't been here for that, but I've heard about it. The traffic out here on the Loretta, think about that one afternoon. And mixed in with all of that is a funeral procession led by the cops and then the hearse, right? And as it's going by, somebody steps into the road down there at Loretta and Steubner, and they stop the hearse, go to the back, open it up, pull out the coffin, and raise to life the person that's died. You think that's going to make the evening news around here, all over the country? What an amazing thing to happen. And brothers and sisters, right here in Luke 7, that is what is happening. At the main intersection of this village with two huge crowds, Jesus steps up, stops a funeral procession, and raises the dead guy. And that just grabs my attention. So much so that I'm fearful sometimes I miss why the story is here. Because while it is a really cool miracle, you will understand that that's not why it's in the Bible, so that we'll pass by there and say, "Wow, that's a cool miracle. Look what happened there." No. Something more important is going on. There are some lessons here about Jesus. That's what we're supposed to see. And so I want us to join the two crowds this morning and pause here at the gate of the village of Nain and be impressed with the miracle, but more importantly, we need to be impressed with the one who worked it and the lessons we're supposed to derive from this incident that the Holy Spirit has preserved for all of us. And so, let's walk down through this text and notice three things about this story that I think teach us something about Jesus. I want to begin by talking to you first this morning about the tragedy. That's the first thing that we encounter as we start working down through this text. There is a tragedy that has taken place. In fact, I want to concentrate on verse 12 because verse 12 does a remarkable job with these very few words of unfolding for us a terrible tragedy. First of all, we learn in verse 12 that someone has died, right? There's been a death. This second crowd, the one coming out of the city, is a funeral procession. In fact, maybe it would be helpful to bear in mind that it is likely that this person who they are carrying out has just died. I mean, like that very day, like just a few hours before. That culture was not like ours, where a funeral may come several days or even a week after a person died. So there's sort of time to sort of process what has happened. That is probably not what is happening here. Remember Ananias and Sapphira, Acts chapter 5, how quickly they are carried out and buried. In that culture, it may have been just a few hours before that this person has died. And so think about how raw the emotion would be at this moment in this crowd that's carrying out this loved one who's passed. We've all been there. We've all been part of the funeral procession. We've all had loved ones who had died. We know the pain and grief that goes with that. We can relate to this crowd going out of the city. We've been there. But there is so much more to this tragedy. That doesn't even begin to tell the story. The second thing we learn, if you're still looking at verse 12, this is Luke 7 and verse 12. Notice that it is a son who has died. Do you see that? And his mother is leading this procession to the cemetery to bury her son. It is not supposed to be that way, is it? Parents are not supposed to bury their children. It's supposed to be the other way around. That's how we anticipate life to work. And when it works the other way, when our children die and parents have to bury their children, we know that that is an especially terrible tragedy. Maybe some of you have seen that too. Maybe some of you remember Hugh and Jenny Walton. I do. They remember Sarah Kleinwood for a while, and while they were here, they had their teenage daughter with them, Wendy. And Wendy was a friend of me and my sister. And after Hugh and Jenny moved away to Georgia, Wendy was killed during her senior year in a terrible car accident right before she was to graduate. And Dorothy and I went out to Georgia for her funeral. She was our good friend. And we were there at the cemetery when Hugh and Jenny had to bury their daughter. What a terrible tragedy that is. And so what I want you to understand is that this is not just some person that has died. This woman has lost her son. And there were implications for her because of that. She was supposed to have him to take care of her. In fact, if you continue on, the text tells us that this was her only son. And the language carries the idea that she is the only child, he is the only child she has ever had. And now he is gone and she is all alone. And for someone in that culture, for someone in our culture, that carried implications. She would have anticipated that in her older years, in her declining years, that her children would have cared for her. But now this source of her future security is gone. Her only son has died. But it's worse than that, because you also notice that we are told she is a widow. This isn't the first time she's led the procession to the cemetery. She's been here before, this time burying the body of her husband for burial. At least on that occasion, she could be comforted by the presence of this son of hers to walk with her and to comfort her during this very difficult time. But now he's gone too. Appreciate what that would have meant for her. It was more than just the painful void of his absence now. Folks, there was no welfare system back at that time. No Social Security, no federal aid for the elderly who were destitute. When her husband had died, she literally would have been dependent on her son to take her into his home and to house her and feed her. And now that he is gone, she doesn't have anybody to take care of her. She would literally have been dependent upon the compassion and mercy of other people. She didn't have the luxury of just grieving his death. She's thinking too about how I will survive. It is in every way a terrible tragedy that has befallen this poor woman. Just just breaks your heart, doesn't it? But not just ours. Are you still in Luke 7? Look at verse 13. Because in verse 13 it says, when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her. We're missing some pieces of the puzzle there, aren't we? That stir my curiosity. I want to know how he knew. Is there a conversation unrecorded where Jesus pauses and talks to this woman? Or is this a John 2 moment where he just knows because he's God and he knows what is in our heart? I don't know. We're not told that part about it. But I do know that he eventually knows. And the text says that he had compassion for her. Barclay, commenting on this text, says that Jesus is moved to the depths of his heart and adds that there is not a stronger word in the Greek language for sympathy. And again, he says in the Gospels, it is used of Jesus. Think about that. He knows what's happened. And he is not indifferent. He's not consumed with other details. In that moment, his heart is with her. He cares about her. We used to sing the song, Does Jesus Care? Do you remember that song? When my heart is pained, when my way is dark, when I've said goodbye to the dearest on earth to me, does he care? The answer of the gospel again and again and again is that he cares, and he cares deeply. His heart is filled with compassion for me when my journey passes through difficult seasons of tragedy and heartbreak. Some wonder, when I'm going through my moments, does Jesus care about me? I would suggest this morning that that question was answered once and forever at the gate of the village of Nain, where we learn that in our moments of tragedy, Jesus does care. That's a lesson to be learned at the gate of Nain. But it is not the only lesson to be learned, because as we press on, we are confronted next with this miracle that takes place. And so let's look there at verse 13, at the miracle Jesus performs. Before we examine what happens, I want to tell you that as a younger preacher, I was given some counsel, Jeff, I bet you got this counsel too, from the older guys about what kinds of things you do and don't do and what you say and what you don't say when you're confronted with grieving people, when you attend a funeral, things like that. Did you get that speech too? Here's what you say, here's what you don't say. My problem is, as I read the story of Luke 7, Jesus breaks all of the rules, right? So what does he say in verse 13 when he goes up to this woman who is confronted with this tragedy? The first thing he says to her is, do not weep. I was told never to say that. That when you're confronted with crying people, let them cry, let them express their grief in whatever way is fitting for them. But listen, if that was sort of out of place, it's only going to get worse. Because in verse 14, the next thing he does is he walks up to the casket and he says, get up! Now, I will tell you, folks, if you go to a funeral and you start walking around telling the family, don't cry, folks are going to be a little uncomfortable about that. But if you walk up to the casket and you say, get up, somebody's going to call the cops and they're going to take you out. Jesus doesn't say any of the right things here, does he? Well, not from Earth's perspective. That's the problem. Heaven's perspective on this scene is completely different. But I wanted you to think about that, because I want you to think about these two crowds who have stopped here at the gate of the village and how bizarre the words of Jesus must have seemed to them. Certainly when he's walking over and saying to the corpse, get up, how bizarre must that have seemed? But listen, he knows what's about to happen. And so do we. But they didn't. And so in verse 15, with this command, the corpse sits up and talks, unmistakable signs of life. Jesus raised the dead son and gave him back to his mother, an act of amazing compassion for this poor woman, but so much more than that. Look over, if you will, just for a minute to John 10. I want to go away from our text just for a second because I want you to see something with me in John 10. The miracle also says something about Jesus, and that is the important thing here in the story. In John 10, in verse 37, Jesus says this, "If I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me." Verse 38, though, he continues, "But if I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works, so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father." I love these two verses because Jesus here is willing to put it all on the line. He said, listen, I can't just run around claiming to be the Messiah, claiming to be the Son of God. Those claims require evidence. And he says in verse 37, if I can't provide the evidence, you shouldn't believe them. But, verse 38, if I do the works, if I can do things that demonstrate the power of deity, though you do not believe me, you need to recognize the implications of the miracle. That's what he said. What Jesus did here at the gate of the village is something only God can do. We understand that. Death is final. Which is one of the things that makes it such a tragedy. Listen, when someone's sick, even when someone is critically ill, there's always hope while life is still present, however weak it might be. But once they have died, we understand. You don't come back from that. That's it. It's over. The battle's lost. And that's where we are in Luke 7. That is until the Son of God intervened. Jesus put life in a dead man. And when he did that, he demonstrated divine power. What are the implications for me and you? Implication, brothers and sisters, is we should believe him. We should believe him because he did the works of the Father and in the process validated his claims. We need to learn that from the story. This is more than just an amazing miracle. It is evidence that he is the Son of God. Third, we need to ponder the response to the miracle. Let's look at the last two verses, 16 and 17. Luke actually records several responses for us. First, he would say in verse 16 that fear gripped them all. Yeah, I bet, don't you? Right about the moment that corpse sits up. I'm thinking that the guys who had been carrying him were probably still standing close by, right? And I think when he stood up, they stepped back. That's what I would have done. I would have been freaked out too. That might be the word if we were translating that we would use. Fear gripped them all. They were witnessing an amazing act of power. And so they're responding, I think, in this moment, emotionally to what's going on. And they're stepping away from this amazing demonstration of power. But even as they do that, they begin to process what they're seeing. Jeff would say they were beginning to connect the dots, right? And so after stepping back and being gripped by fear, the text next says that they began glorifying God. Do you see them connecting the dots? Now they see that something bigger is going on here. This isn't just a wonder, one of the words used in the Bible for a miracle, because that's what it produces. It produces wonder. This is also a sign, another word in the Bible used for a miracle, because the miracle said something. It carried a message, and this one did. It was telling them something about Jesus. And so in the moment, their minds begin to process, what is this? What has happened? And what does it say to us? And so the next thing they say in verse 14, a great prophet has risen among us. Verse 16. Now they're beginning to work through this like Nicodemus did in John 3:2. You remember he came to Jesus by night and he says, we know something. We know that you have come from God as a teacher. For nobody could do the signs that you do unless God is with him. And that's what they're beginning to realize. They don't have it all figured out. They call him a great prophet, and I wonder how much about that prophet part they're getting at this point. A great prophet or the great prophet? Maybe some even had a more complete picture here than others. But the pieces are coming together, and they realize that there's something special about Jesus. And in that, a hope begins to grow. Next, they say, God has visited his people. And boy, that's ripe language, isn't it, Jeff? Jeff could do a better job of explaining the Old Testament ramifications of that lesson. In fact, we see Zacharias use it in Luke chapter 1 and verse 68 as he prophesies about the work of John the Baptist and the coming of Jesus. With the coming of this great prophet, they anticipate and are even now seeing a blessing for God's people. And so you can imagine now, fear has turned into excitement as they begin to anticipate the possibilities here. And so what happens? Verse 17 says, this report concerning him went out everywhere. How could it not? How could you hold in such an amazing thing that had happened and the implications that they began to see and what had taken place here at the gate of the village? Word about it spread everywhere. It makes me wonder, how are we impressed with Jesus? I wonder, have we put the pieces together even better than the people here at the gate of the village? We understand the miracles and their meaning and how they tie to the teaching and the claims to Jesus, and we have connected the dots. We understand that he was the Son of God and the Savior, the promised Messiah of the Old Testament who rescues us from sin. We understand that the greatest expression of his compassion was his sacrificial death that delivers us from our choice to sin. We love him for what he has done for us. Which then I think raises a question. Who am I telling? That was the response of the people here at the gate of the village. When they began to figure out what was going on, they went and told everybody about it. I'm not surprised by that, are you? I think that is exactly the way one should respond to such amazing news. What is surprising, brothers and sisters, is that we could even have it better put together than they did, and we don't tell anybody. No, what we do is get on Facebook and gripe and complain about how awful our culture is and what's going on with the political situation. But what we do not do is share the cure for what ills our culture. We don't go tell everybody about Jesus. And I would just submit, as we look at this story here in Luke chapter 7, that is one of the lessons, that in light of what has taken place, the only right response is to go tell other people about Jesus. Do you believe that too? So who will you tell? Who will you go out and tell tomorrow? Or today? Who do you know that needs the good news? Two crowds met at the gate of the village. One going out to the cemetery, the other following Jesus in. My guess is, after what happened at the gate, nobody went to the cemetery that day. What took place changed everything. But in a very real sense, brothers and sisters, we too, even this morning, have had an encounter with Jesus. We've been given an opportunity through the account preserved for us in Luke 7 to consider again, not just his claims, but to witness the works of the Father that Jesus did, proving his claims were true. We too get to be part of the crowds who see Jesus raise the dead, validating that he is the Son of God and he is our Savior. Now we make a choice to. It's hard to imagine anybody witnessing that scene and not joining the crowd following him into the village. It's hard to imagine anybody walking away from him on that day, isn't it? So the question is, what choice will you and I make on this day? How would it be possible that I would know today that my life is not right with God, either because I never made the choice to be a disciple or I've wandered off that path, whatever my situation is, if I know that things are not right between me and Him, how can I make the choice today to walk away in the wrong crowd? To leave the one who could raise the dead, to leave the one who gives me spiritual life. If you know things are right between you and the Lord, what we're hoping today is that you will make a different choice. You will make a choice to follow Him. We want to help you with that. If this morning you need Him, we encourage you to make your way to the front right now while we stand, while we sing.